Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores and for supporting our author events. We really appreciate it. Well, as you know, Justin Cronin is a New York Times bestselling author of The Passage, and he is here to talk about the next story in the trilogy, The 12. It is debuted on the New York Times bestseller list at number 2, which is excellent. There's still time. Anyway, I'm just going to give him the time tonight, so please welcome Justin Cronin.
Hello, beautiful people. How are you? Thank you for having me. Thank you for coming to Tattered Cover. I love this store. I love this. I've never done an event here. I did an event at a different Tattered Cover, and I have great sentimental love for independent bookstores. My wife, when I met her, was behind the counter of an independent bookstore reading Rilke. It was pretty hot. where do I start? It's nice to see you all here. I actually like to start with the story of the worst book event I ever did. It just kind of helps keep things in perspective. There was a time when, you know, not so many people came. And when my first book, Mary and O'Neill, came out in 2001, I asked my publisher when I would be going on my international tour of the capitals of Europe. And he explained to me very gently that no such thing was forthcoming. But if I wanted to do some book events, I should feel free to schedule a few on my own. So I was teaching in Philadelphia at the time, and I went to the local it was a chain store near in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, and I said, I'm Justin Cronin, can I do an event? And they said, if you want. And I put up the posters and I scheduled the event. And I went and they took me upstairs where they had this embarrassingly tall pile of books. They must have had like 50 books, all of which would be sent back to the publisher, okay? And there was a little desk, and they said, there's your desk. And that was my introduction. And I waited, and nobody came. And then three people came. Three people showed up, and they were all my students. And they all wanted extra credit. The first thing I said to them, of course, was like, are you all 21? Because I'm buying if you wanted to get out of here, right? And they said, oh, no, Professor Cronin, we want you to read to us. So I did, and it wasn't too bad, and then towards the end of the reading, a fourth figure kind of started hovering at the back and got progressively closer and appeared to be, listening, and I was not related to that person, and I did not know them. I had never taught them. I did not owe them money, as far as I was aware. They were a reader. And so, everything concluded, and I'm talking to my student, and the woman she approaches, and I said, hello, and how are you? And thanks for coming. And would you like me to sign a book? And she said, are you done? Because my reading group meets here on Tuesday nights. There you go. It's especially nice to be in Denver because, of course, I destroyed Denver twice, once in each book. And I feel a little bad about that, but I do it with love. I mean, Denver was originally sort of an arbitrary pick, because I just needed like a big city in the middle of the country, that was you guys. So, I spent some time driving around, getting the lay of the land, and I've seen people actually on Facebook post things like, I know the building Kittredge is in, right? That's pretty cool. There is some phony geography in there. At the end of the day, you can't make everything always work completely. I mean, I try to make things as exact as I can and let reality dictate. So I did have to make up some street names and some things like that. I was just, after a while, you're like staring at the map and you're trying to figure things, and you finally say, oh, the hell with it. I'll just call it Main Street. But anyway, so I'm going to read a section. I'll get to this section, but I am going to read a little bit of Denver for y'all. Now, here's the thing. For the events like this, what I really like to do is do a Q&A. I just feel like it's the way for people to, you know, I don't know what you want to know. You know, it's better if you ask. So Q&As always have a kind of awkward moment in them when you say, are there any questions? And for some excruciating number of questions, nobody raises a hand, right? We know what this is like. It's kind of tough. So here's the deal, and I've done this at every event that I've done. The first hand to go up, that person gets a Christmas card from me. Okay, right, all right, all right. When we get to the Q&A section now, just calm down, all right, okay, all right? And we, you know, we take the Christmas card very seriously in my household. You know, we don't do internet Christmas cards or any of that baloney. No, it's we go in for the real Christmas card. So so whoever is that person, there's a lovely young lady in the back who's taking care of me, and she will get your name and address and send it to my publicist for the master 12-passage Christmas card list, okay? And I will not forget. I will not fail you. I will send you a Christmas card. All right, so I'm here to talk about the 12, really. I'm thinking most of the people in the room kind of know what the passage is about, so I don't have to explain it, which is nice because it's 337,000 words long. So first of all, congratulations to all those of you who finished my first book. When I finished the first draft, I usually finish books at like 4 in the morning for some reason. It tends to be when that happens. But this, when I finished the passage, that wasn't... And you finish a book about 8 different times, actually. So there's kind of less drama to that than you think. I mean, you really finish it the day it's published and you can't change anything. But the first time I got through a whole draft... At that time, I was working in the garage. Now I get to work above the garage, which is kind of nice. But I was working in the garage, and I came into the house, and it was dinner hour. My wife was, you know, making dinner for the kids. And she said, well, and I said, yeah, I finished it. And she said, so how long is it? And I said, it's 337,000 words. And she looked at me, and she says, well, somebody's in love with the sound of his own voice. Fair enough. The 12. Writing the 12 presented me with some interesting challenges. With every book I write, I really want to do something new, something I haven't done before. It's sort of my project. It kind of keeps me interested. And, you know, the best thing about being a writer is you have no boss. So you can kind of do what you want and, you know, take your lumps if it fails and get a ticker tape parade if it succeeds, I guess. But what I wanted to do with this book was avoid the second novel trap. Do we know what the second novel trap is? Yeah, it's kind of famous. And it means that the second book is just kind of a long second act. It's just trying to get you from the first book to the third book. It's like trying to swim across the pool underwater, holding its breath as long as it can and get to the other side, right? And there's nothing wrong with continuing the story, and you have to do that. And indeed, I do that in the 12, but I didn't want a book that just borrowed all of its energy from the previous novel. So what I decided to do, and this was always part of the plan, was to go back to year zero again. And each of the books is going to do this. In fact, I'm working on the third book, and it actually goes a little pre-year zero, right? I like how the past kind of puts pressure on the future. So in each of the books, we go back to the past, to year zero, to show you something you did not see the first time. Or, more likely, because I'm so clever, something that you saw out of the corner of your eye and did not know it was as important as it was, right? Something you thought was just a glancing detail or something that seemed to be over and done and not a matter of permanent consequence turns out to be just the opposite, okay? And some of you, I hope, remember in the passage a little moment when Wolgast comes down the mountain. He and Amy have gotten sort of firmly ensconced in their little mountain hideaway. And he goes down to kind of get supplies and find out what's going on with the world. And he goes to that little general store, right? And he reads the newspaper. That's where the newspaper article is that describes, you know, the sort of chaos that's erupted. Chaos in Colorado is the headline, right? That's fun to write. It's alliterative, too. You know, it's, and then he talks to the guy, and, you know, he's down there to buy, you know, food and bullets and all that stuff. And then he briefly mentions that there's a video blog being posted by a guy in a downtown, in a high-rise in Denver with a high-powered rifle, right, shooting virals, and he's become famous, right? I mean, this is the great footage that the world is enjoying, and he calls himself or has come to be known as Last Stand in Denver, right? This is all about two sentences in the book, right? This is what is known as a plant, ladies and gentlemen, okay? Now, sometimes you do things for a reason. And that man, Last Stand in Denver, becomes somebody who, you know, despite his best efforts, actually has a profound effect on the future. So what I'd like to do is just to read a little bit of him. I really like this character, and I just kind of got intoxicated by writing him. I think he's terrific. And so I'm going to just read a little bit from that, and then we'll move on to the Q&A. The other thing I'll say about this part of the novel is doing it, you know, I always liked it, but I was doing an event in Chicago, and a guy came up to me, and I have a lot of readers, and this is something I hadn't anticipated, and it's very interesting for me. I have a lot of readers who are veterans or active duty military, which is, you know, I never served, right? So, you know, whenever I write about the military, I basically have to go ask people and talk to people, and in fact, you know, I have one guy who's a former student who's became an infantry officer who's helped me a great deal. But, you know, you try to be accurate, but I feel a sort of special obligation not to fake it with military stuff. I mean, last time I checked, we were involved in two theaters of combat right now. And what I've heard is that, and this is the line that a guy who's over there gave me, he said, books are to deployment what cigarettes are to prison. Right. I mean, yeah, people over there read a ton. I have a number of former students over there who have confirmed the same thing. But I was in Chicago, and a guy came up to me, and he was a wounded Iraq vet. He was wounded in 2005, just, you know, right when Iraq was a total mess, right? You know, right after Fallujah. It was when things were really just awful. I was a real meat grinder, and he had received a bad head injury and an IED explosion and some other injuries as well, and had been evacuated to New Orleans like 2 weeks before Katrina. Okay, right. And, you know, and we were talking, and he said something to me that just made a real difference to me. He just said, you know, with Kittredge, you got it right. You got it right. And he wasn't just talking about the hardware. He was talking about the experience. So I'm going to read just a bit. I know that I've been to a lot of readings, and they come dangerously close to hostage situations if they go on too long. So I will keep this fairly short, and then we'll go on to the Christmas card portion of our program, ladies and gentlemen. All right. All right. Bernard Kittredge, known to the world as Last Stand in Denver, realized it was time to leave the morning the power went out. He wondered what had taken so long. You couldn't keep a municipal electrical grid running without people to man it, and as far as Kittredge could tell from the 19th floor, not a single human soul was left alive in the city of Denver, which was not to say he was alone. He'd passed the early hours of the morning, a bright, clear morning in the first week of June, temperatures in the mid-70s with a chance of blood-sucking monsters moving in toward dusk, sunning on the balcony of the penthouse he had occupied since the second week of the crisis. It was a gigantic place, like an airborne palace. The kitchen alone was the size of Kittredge's whole apartment. The owner's taste ran in an austere direction, sleek leather seating groups that were better to look at than sit on, gleaming floors of twinkling travertine, small furry rugs, glass tables that appeared to float in space. Breaking in had been surprisingly simple. By the time Kittredge had made his decision, half the city was dead or fled or missing. The cops were long gone. He'd thought about barricading himself into one of the big houses in Cherry Creek, but based on the things he'd seen, he wanted someplace high. The owner of the penthouse was a man he knew slightly, a regular customer at the store. His name was Warren Philo. As luck would have it, Warren had come into the store the day before the whole thing broke to gear up for a hunting trip to Alaska. He was a young guy, too young for how much money he had, Wall Street money probably, or one of those high-tech IPOs. And on that day, the world still humming along as usual, Kittredge had helped Warren carry his purchases to the car. A Ferrari, of course. Standing beside it, Kittredge thought, why not just go ahead and get a vanity plate that says Douchebag 1? A question that must have been plainly written on his face, because no sooner had he thought it than Warren went red with embarrassment. He wasn't wearing his usual suit, just jeans and a t-shirt with Sloan School of Management on the front. He'd wanted Kittredge to see his car. That was obvious. But now that he'd allowed this to happen, he'd realized how dumb it was showing off a vehicle like that to a floor manager at Outdoor World who probably made less than 50 grand a year. The number was actually 46. Kittredge allowed himself a silent laugh at that. The things this kid didn't know would fill a book. And he let the moment hang to make the point. I know, Warren confessed. It's a little much. I told myself I'd never be one of those assholes who drove a Ferrari. But honest to God, you should feel the way she handles. Kittredge had gotten Warren's address off the invoice. By the time he moved in, Warren, presumably snug and safe in Alaska, it was simply a matter of finding the right key in the manager's office, putting it into the slot in the elevator panel, and riding 18 floors to the penthouse. He unloaded his gear. A rolling suitcase of clothes, three lockers of weaponry, a hand crank radio, night vision binoculars, flares, a first aid kit, bottles of bleach, an arc welder to seal the doors of the elevator, his laptop with its satellite dish, a box of books, and enough food and water to last a month. The view from the balcony, which ran the length of the west side of the building, was a sweeping 180 degrees looking toward Interstate 25 and Mile High Field. He'd positioned cameras with motion detectors at each end of the balcony, one to cover the street, a second facing the building on the opposite side of the avenue. He'd figured he'd get a lot of good footage that way, but the money shots would be actual kills. The weapon he'd selected for this task was a Remington bolt-action 700P, 338 caliber, a nice balance of accuracy and stopping power, zeroing out at 300 yards. To this, he'd affixed a digital video scope with infrared. Using the binoculars, he would isolate his target. The rifle, mounted on a bipod at the edge of the balcony, would do the rest. On the first night, windless, lit by a waning quarter moon, Kittredge shot 7. 5 on the avenue, 1 on the opposite roof, and 1 more through the window of a bank at street level. It was the last one that made him famous. The creature, or vampire, or whatever it was, the official term was infected person, had looked straight into the lens just before Kittredge put one through the sweet spot. Uploaded to YouTube, the image had traveled around the globe within hours. By morning, all the major networks had picked it up. Who is this man? Everybody wanted to know. Who is this fearless, crazy, suicidal man barricaded in a Denver high-rise making his last stand? And so was born the name Last Stand in Denver. From the start, he'd assumed it was just a matter of time before somebody shut him down, CIA or NSA or Homeland. He was making quite a stir. Working in his favor was the fact that this same somebody would have to come to Denver to pull the plug. Kittredge's IP address was functionally untraceable, backstopped by a daisy chain of anonymizing servers. Their orders scrambled every night. Most of them were overseas. Russia, China, Indonesia, Israel, Sudan. Places beyond easy reach for any federal agency. His video blog, 2 million hits the first day, had more than 300 mirror sites with more added all the time. It didn't take a week before he was a bona fide worldwide phenomenon. Twitter, Facebook, Headshot, Sphere, the images found their way into the ether without his having to lift a finger. One of his fan sites had more than 2 million subscribers. On eBay, t-shirts that read, "I am Last Stand in Denver," were selling like hotcakes. His father had always said, "Son, the most important thing in life is to make a contribution." Who would have thought that Kittredge's contribution would be video blogging from the front lines of the apocalypse? And yet the world went on. The sun still shone. To the west, the mountains shrugged their indifferent rocky bulk at man's departure. For a while, there had been a lot of smoke. Whole blocks had burned to the ground. But now this had dissipated, revealing the desolation with eerie clarity. At night, regions of blackness blotted the city, but elsewhere lights still glittered in the gloom, flickering street lamps, filling stations, and convenience stores with their distinctive fluorescent glow, porch lights left burning for their owner's return. While Kittredge maintained his vigil on the balcony, A traffic signal 18 floors below still dutifully turned from green to yellow to red to green again. He wasn't lonely. Loneliness had left him long ago. He was 34 years old. A little heavier than he might have liked. With his leg, it was hard to keep the weight off, but still strong. He'd been married once, years before. He remembered that period of his life as 20 months of oversexed connubial bliss, followed by an equal number of months of yelling and screaming, accusations and counter-accusations, until the whole thing sank like a rock, and he was content on the whole that this union had produced no children. His connection to Denver was neither sentimental nor personal. After he'd gotten out of the VA, it was simply where he'd landed. Everyone said that a decorated veteran should have little trouble finding work, and maybe this was true, but Kittredge had been in no hurry. He'd spent the better part of a year just reading the usual stuff at first, cop novels and thrillers, but eventually had found his way to more substantial books. As I Lay Dying, For Whom the Bell Tolls, Huckleberry Finn, The Great Gatsby. He'd spent a whole month on Melville, drilling his way through Moby Dick. Most were the books he felt he ought to read, the ones he'd missed in school, but he genuinely liked most of them. Sitting in the quiet of his apartment, his mind lost in tales of other lives and times, felt like taking a long drink after years of thirst. He'd even enrolled in a few classes at the community college, working at Outdoor World during the day, reading and writing his papers at nights and on his lunch hour. There was something in the pages of these books that had the power to make him feel better about things, a life raft to cling to before the currents of memory washed him downstream again. And on brighter days, he could even see himself going on this way for some time, a small but passable life. And then, of course, the end of the world had happened. The morning the electricity failed, Kittredge had finished uploading the previous night's footage and was sitting on the patio reading Dickens' Tale of Two Cities when the thought touched him that the morning could only be improved by a dish of ice cream. Warren's enormous kitchen, you could run a 5-star restaurant out of the thing, had been, unsurprisingly, almost completely bereft of food, but the guy obviously had a weakness for Ben and Jerry's chocolate fudge brownie because the freezer was crammed with the stuff. Not Chunky Monkey or Cherry Garcia or fish food or even plain old vanilla, just chocolate fudge brownie. Kittredge would have liked some variety, considering that there was going to be no more ice cream for a while, but with little else to eat besides canned soup and crackers, he was hardly going to complain. Balancing his book on the arm of his chair, he rose and stepped through the sliding glass door into the penthouse. By the time he reached the kitchen, he had begun to sense that something was off kilter, although his impression had yet to coalesce around anything specific. It wasn't until he opened the carton and sank his spoon into a soft mush of melted chocolate fudge brownie that he fully understood. He tried a light switch. Nothing. He moved through the apartment, testing lamps and switches. All were the same. In the middle of the living room, Kittredge paused and took a deep breath. Okay, he thought, okay. This was to be expected. If anything, this was long overdue. He checked his watch, 9:32 a.m. Sunset was a little after 8. He had 10.5 hours to get his ass gone. He threw together a rucksack of supplies, protein bars, bottles of water, clean socks and underwear, his first aid kit, a warm jacket, a bottle of Zyrtec, his allergies had been playing hell with him all spring, a toothbrush and a razor. For a moment he considered bringing Tale of Two Cities along, but this seemed impractical, and with a twinge of regret he put it aside. In the bedroom he dressed himself in a wicking t-shirt and cargo pants, topping this off with a hunting vest. For a few minutes, he considered which weapons to take before settling on a Bowie knife, a pair of Glock 19s, and the Polish AK with the folding stock, useless at any kind of range but reliable close in where he expected to be. The Glocks fit snugly in a cross-draw holster. He filled the pockets of his vest with loaded magazines, clipped the AK to its sling, hoisted the backpack over his shoulders, and returned to the patio. That was when he noticed the traffic signal on the avenue. Green, yellow, red, green, yellow, red. It could have been a fluke, but he doubted it. They'd found him. The rope was anchored to a drainage stack on the roof. He stepped into his rappelling harness, clipped in, and swung first his good leg and then his bad one over the railing. Heights were no problem for him, and yet he did not look down. He was perched on the edge of the balcony, facing the windows of the penthouse. From the distance, he heard the sound of an approaching helicopter. Last stand in Denver, signing off. And I will stop there. To write these books, I had to learn an awful lot about firearms, which, you know, I'm a man of peace. And I didn't know very much, to be honest. I'd, you know, shot a few rifles as a kid. But to write The Passage, I had to go learn a lot about handguns. There's a lot of handguns in it. So, I went. I live in Texas, and my guess is that Colorado is much the same. It's very easy to learn about guns in Texas. You just, you know, go to the range and ask somebody, and hours pass, and you know, you have a hell of a good time, and I can't wait to go back. But for this one, of course, I had to learn how to shoot basically a sniper rifle, right? And I'd never done that, so I did what anybody in Texas would do when they need to learn to shoot a sniper rifle, is I asked my dentist to teach me. I was getting my regular checkup, and I remembered that he was a hunter. He had shared a lease on a piece of land in South Texas, went down every year to bag his deer, and so he's got his gloved hands in my mouth. His name is Rudy. I'm like, Rudy, I have a question. And I said, I need to learn to shoot a rifle. Would you teach me? And I've never seen a man so happy. Okay. I mean, he looked at me and he actually said this. He said, I'm closing the office right now. he didn't. We waited till the end of the day, but not a day went by. Does anybody have any questions? That was the first one back there, the gentleman with the Van Dyke. Yes. All right. Yes.
What was your big break going from a literature professor to an international bestseller? Was the aligning of the stars?
Well, it was. You know, I don't know. The question is, what was my big break? You know, my big break was actually my daughter telling me my other books were boring, right? I mean, that's really how it happened. She was 8 years old, and she expressed the very earnest concern. I sort of out of the blue, we were folding laundry, as it so happened, and that maybe my books were boring. And she was a big reader. You know, she in the second grade, she read To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, she's that kind of kid. So. And I asked her, of course, have you read my other books? And she said, oh, no, I would never bother reading your books. But, I looked at the covers, you know, and being told that you're boring is actually something that every writer occasionally probably needs to hear. You know, like, you know, maybe I, you know, maybe it was time to do something else. And that led to the experience, which it's sort of lore about this, about The Passage. I mean, people sort of know the story, so I'll tell it very quickly. But I came up with the outline of this book, and I plan a novel. I don't just sort of go wait for ideas to fall from above and sit at the typewriter waiting for something to happen. I plan it all in advance. I outlined the book with her. I was jogging. She was on her bike. We did this every day for an hour for a period of about 3 months right after school. Because when she said that my books were boring, I said to her, okay, smarty pants, what should I write about? And she said, a girl who saves the world. I was like, well, that was the thing out of her mouth. And I said, okay, fine, all right, you have to help me do this. And it was just a game. I had no intention of writing a book. We were just playing a game. I was actually really trying to improve her rather sketchy bicycle riding skills. And so, you know, she was wobbling through the neighborhood, and we played a game called Let's Plan a Novel. And I'd actually done something rather like this with my creative writing students for many, many years. It's sort of my best parlor trick is, you know, throw a dart at a map and give me a gender and an age, and you know, and I could sort of start spitting a story out of it. And I'd done it for years. This time I did it with my kid. So there was no inner critic present. There was no intention to actually write a book. And the only rule was that it had to be interesting and had to have one character with red hair. Those are the rules, right? Because my daughter's a redhead. That's Alicia, right? The badass redhead of The Passage. So, and so it was just like our chemistry kind of doing this. So, of course, it became a father-daughter story, did it not? I mean, that was the natural thing, was the Wolgast-Amy relationship becoming very central to it. But, you know, the other thing that you know, sort of drives writers is you know, real life. You know, real life. Like, I needed to write another book. It was time to write another book. Or, the little birdies would be hungry in the nest, you know, right? And I came across this great idea. I always try to write the book that asks itself to be written. This is the one that asked me. I was actually writing another book at the time that was actually kind of splashing in the shallows, you know, and I was feeling frustrated by it. So I did this thing with my kid, and by the time it's all over, it'll be 800,000 words is my guess. That's actually the length of 8 normal novels. Why do I do this? I do not know. Okay, next question, please. Yes. I'm sorry that I know you were psyched. I'll put you on the list. I'll put you on the list anyway. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm part of wise because I told my students that I was coming to see you, and they know that I started reading over the summer, and I was all, woo, doing my thing. And this one is my son, by the way, and he heard you talking. He turned to me and goes, this doesn't sound like a very bad book at all.
Okay.
which is not my question. So we sat around and had a talk on Halloween about monsters and what we think are American monsters. Argument erupted about whether or not vampires are American monsters.
Right. No, they're actually Eastern European.
And they had a very solid argument for why they think it has become an American monster. And I said, well, I'm going to go ask Justin Cronin if he thinks that the vampire is an American. And if you think that it's becoming an American monster, do you see yourself sort of changing the mythology of that?
Okay, so the question is, do I see vampires as American monsters in some deep way? And my sense of the vampire story, I started this project before those other books, okay, right? Well, and they were written for a totally different demographic. I didn't hear about them for quite a while, and I have not read them. Right, I drove a carpool with seventh grade girls, so I know all about them. Right, but you know, anyway. So my experience is all completely separate from this stuff. We have four monsters. There's like basically four. Right, there is the werewolf, there is the zombie, there is the Frankenstein, and there is the vampire. Right, those are the big four, as far as I can tell. Right, and the thing about it is the vampire is the most interesting. Intrinsically, because it has the most stuff. It has the most details in the story. The werewolf, pretty simple. Men are dogs. We know this, right? That's not like big news, okay, right? It's just basically a little Freudian drama, okay? The Frankenstein monster, sort of the gas has been let out of that, I think, in a way. I mean, my iPhone is now the Frankenstein monster. We're all like completely, you know, comfortable with it. So it seems kind of less frightening. Once in a while, it gets resuscitated. But the last good Frankenstein was Hal in 2001, as far as I'm concerned. Although The Matrix was a Frankenstein monster story, too, which was pretty good. The vampire... Oh, and zombies, of course. Now, zombies are hot right now, right? Everybody wants to make out with a zombie. In fact, I was just watching... I just downloaded another episode of Walking Dead, and I was watching in my hotel room before I got here. So don't tell me how the third episode works out, please. So zombies, we're having a little zombie thing right now. The thing about zombies is they're great, but they're already dead, which is a problem because ultimately... In every zombie story, every zombie movie, every zombie TV show, eventually people, you know, kind of figure that out and discover that not only is shooting them a good idea, it's actually kind of pleasurable. So it becomes, you know, it sort of becomes like shooting things in the head slapstick, right? Which you can get a lot of mileage out of as far as I'm concerned, and I could watch it all day, but it's not rich. The vampire story is very rich. So I'm going to go back to your question, is it an American monster? And the answer is it absolutely can be made into anything you want it to be. That's what's great about it. I decided before the current vampire thing, right, that I wanted to use the vampires as my boogeymen because I had noticed a couple of things. I had noticed essentially that it was a very, very plastic, soft clay that you could mold and actually attach to other myths and anxieties. That's what's good about it, right? You can take, you know, the zombie thing is actually pretty good. It's, you know, it's a metaphor for consumerism. For instance, you can do certain things with it. But the vampire story is like almost infinitely pliable, right? And I thought of two, and I'd noticed this for years and had been interested in it. Two films in particular had showed me this. One was an early film by the director Catherine Bigelow called Near Dark. Has anybody seen this movie? Right. Yeah. It's a kind of low budget. It's not a fancy movie at all. It's about a bunch of vampires driving around the American West in a Winnebago, killing everybody at truck stops and roadside bars, basically. And it's, you know, it's a sort of exuberantly cheesy film. But what it does is it takes the vampire story and Americanizes humanizes it by just sticking it onto a very particular American landscape and American myth, which is the sort of the wide open spaces of the West and the highway drifter serial killer figure, right? That's a very particular American thing, this sort of lone maniac in the wide open spaces. The other one I noticed was the Bram Stoker's Dracula film that was done by Ford Coppola in the early 90s. If you look at that movie carefully, it is clearly a movie about AIDS. It's absolutely drenched in blood. Everything about vampirism, it sort of goes, it uses the seduction part of the myth as that's what it emphasizes. And essentially it's people being seduced into a dangerous sexual relationship, okay? And that was right at the height of kind of general AIDS panic. It was not long after, it was not much after, for instance, Magic Johnson had sort of, and that was an event that sort of made everybody suddenly feel like, oh, anybody can get this. It had sort of moved out of, you know, it could come into the general population. So it was a period of great anxiety. The movie responded to that and used the vampire story for it. So that's, you know, in a sense, you can make it about what you want. You know, I'm sure there's some limits, but you can make it about what you wanted to make it about. What I wanted to do, and there were two things I wanted to do here. One was I wanted to take magic out of the story. I don't like magic in novels. It's just kind of a free-for-all. Yeah, I don't like elves either. I don't know why. All right? But I don't like magic because it's just sort of this like infinite deus ex machina. Like, oh, and then some magic happened and the novel ended, right? And so I wanted, what I wanted to do is I wanted to, the idea was that every legend has got a reality behind it, particularly if it's a really ubiquitous legend. You know, every culture's got something or other like a vampire. Where does this come from? So I have a bunch of scientists go looking for its biological basis, right? And that's what the story does. The other thing is I wanted a boogeyman that really kind of reflected our current anxieties, right? And I started this book, thinking about this book in 2005, 2006, right? And I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up thinking I was going to be incinerated with about 15 minutes notice, right? And then in 1989, that fear went away, right? You know, but there was something about the best thing about the Cold War, of course, was that we knew what to be afraid of. Then after 9/11, we kind of didn't know anymore, but all the anxiety came back. There's a sentence that describes the virals, and you don't really get to look at them very much in the book. I mean, they kind of come out of the corner of your eye and swoop down upon you. They come from above. That's the line. This is something that readers don't have to kind of pick up on to understand what I'm doing, but I wanted something that flew down upon you like the planes of 9/11. That's what I was working with, right? The sort of, you know, this sort of sense that everything's going fine and then wham, it just out of nowhere, this thing will hit you. And that was part of my design, was to, in a sense, kind of mold the vampire story into something that would reflect our contemporary anxieties, not just terrorism, but also pandemic, which has always concerned me. We build a perfect world for the rapid dissemination of highly lethal and contagious viruses. The Spanish influenza in 1918 killed 50 million people worldwide. That was a world with ships. Right. I worry about this all the time. Okay, I really do. I became something of a student of the Spanish influenza many years ago before it got hot. Right. I was the Spanish flu before the Spanish flu was cool. My grandmother's brother died of Spanish flu in the fall of 1918. So that's the other thing I was thinking about. That's a very long answer, but yeah. Somebody else, sir.
I know you said at your passage book signing that you like to use like the classic vampire novel. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, since all the classics have like the kind of religious underpinning, mm-hmm. this clash between like God and Satan, and they're always using that, is Greer your character or your hat tip to that?
Well, there's absolutely a religious undercurrent in these stories. I had meant to drag my feet on I'm sorry, I always have to repeat the question and I always forget. I have somebody in the back putting her, cupping her, you know, her hand to her ear, and I just blew her cover. But so the question has to do with the way religion operates in these stories and in relation to, you know, other vampire stories. I think of the passage in the 12 as not strictly speaking vampire stories. I mean, I sort of borrowed vampire material to do it, and I think of it as more like apocalyptic fiction. Or I think of it as, the 12 I think of as in some ways a spy novel. I think of the passage as a Western and as a road novel. You know, it's got probably more to do with the Odyssey than it does with vampire stories, strictly speaking. But If you're going to destroy the world, right, it automatically raises basic theological questions and invokes a whole, you know, a tsunami of other writings on the subject, right? I mean, I called it Project Noah. I mean, I was not going to hide this. But I'd meant to drag my feet on the question of religion a little more than I did. I was writing I started writing the passage, and I came upon the character of Sister Lacey Antoinette Cadotto, and all of a sudden, like, that door flew open. And I realized this wasn't just going to be something I could get to over time. It was really central to the whole story. And I had always known that what we were looking at, you know, the story that you see in the passage and in the 12 is the reality behind something that 1,000 years from now has become legend, right? In 1,000 years in the future, there's this academic conference taking place, right? We all know this. Guess what? The world doesn't end. I mean, it's built into the very beginning of the book, right? 1,000 years in the future, academic conferences will still be held, right? I don't know if that's good news or bad, but they will be studying this. And the language that they attach to some of these original documents is the language of religion. You know, they call Sarah's diary the Book of Sarah. They call Auntie's writings the Book of Auntie. And there's others. I mean, if you've started reading the 12, it opens, well, okay, it opens with a religious document, something that's called the Writings of the First Recorder, the Book of 12s. And it's, you know, it's meant to actually help readers remember what happened in the first book, right? I mean, obviously, like, my designs are apparent, but nevertheless, it's also there because the story of Amy is one that has become, in, you know, at some distant future time, you know, the story of a savior, with all of the trappings of that. So the one thing I tell people about the way religion operates in these books is that you get to decide as the reader whether or not God exists and pays attention in the world of the passage, right? It's not definitive. I mean, I'll give you an example. Because you get to decide this in your own life, too, and I wouldn't want to, you know, I'm not going to take that away from you. So you could look at Lacey Antoinette Cadotto or Lucius Greer later on, because he becomes the sort of next Lacey, right? Lucius the Faithful. You could look at Lacey as a bona fide mystic in touch with a divine reality, a plane of existence that we cannot actually see, and she is in communion with it, some divinity in the universe. Or she's somebody who has the worst case of post-traumatic stress disorder you ever saw because of what happened to her in Sierra Leone when she was a little girl, right? And you get to pick. You get to pick. The book does steer it in some directions. What I think does nudge it in certain directions sometimes. But for the most part, I really wanted to let the reader make that call. All right. And, you know, I hope to do that successfully in the last book as well. I will take one more because her hand's like already up. Young writers, my advice is be patient. It takes a really long time, and you learn to write by reading, right? You know, so in a sense, you don't even need to write yet. Just read everything. Read all the time. Read difficult books. Read simple books. Read for pleasure. Read for pain. You know, because always people always talk about reading for pleasure. I also talk about reading for pain. Just read everything, because what will happen is you'll get a sort of muscle memory in your brain for language and storytelling. All right. What I tell writers in general is one rule, which is that the first rule of writing is the same as the first rule for any job, right? You must show up, right? You got to write every day if you're going to do this, you know, even if it means that it's 20 minutes on the subway. I know somebody who wrote a novel 20 minutes on the subway at a time. Right? But she did it every single day. And that's how this stuff gets written. That's how books happen. If you just walk around thinking about it, nothing happens. Right? If you write 1,000 words a day for 100 days, you have a novel. It may be bad. Right? Okay? It probably is. But you have something that you can fix or learn from. And then write the next one. Thanks a lot.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.